Next time I ran into him was over at the girls' halfway house. So he's like me. He likes the variation in his meetings and likes to go to a bunch of them. I haven't heard Ray talk, but I've shared some comments with him and certainly enjoyed the things that I've heard. So I'd certainly like for you to help me welcome Ray, please. My name is Ray Rowe. I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Ray.
Sounds like you really need this program. I hear a lot of talk, so sometimes I think maybe I'm just a problem drinker. I don't know, but I did have some problems with alcohol. First of all, I want to thank each and every one of you for being here tonight. I really mean that. And a special thanks to those of you that were here before me to help me when I came. I really mean that. Well, it never does take me long to get drunk. I'm going to get drunk here pretty quick. And it usually takes me quite a while to get sober. But if you'll stick around to the very last, I think it'll be worth waiting for. Because the last bit of it is really the best part. And if anybody gets through before I do, I just feel free to leave. Won't bother me one bit. I'm from Kentucky, where they make bourbon whiskey, and I love it. I drink it. I'm a carpenter. Been in the Carpenters Union for 37 years, and a hard hat, and I worked hard, and by God, I drank hard. If you'd have told me what booze was going to do to me rather than what it was doing for me, I would have never believed it. I thought I was too smart to ever let a booze or anything else control me. I just never believed that I couldn't stop or control it if it got to be a real problem to me. I started out drinking booze and I enjoyed it, and it got to be habit, and then it got to be an obsession, and totally destroyed me, and not only me, my family, and a lot of a lot of people around me. I drank it, way back there as a kid, and I never will. Forget, I can't remember my first drink of milk or water or coffee or anything else, but I can remember that first time I really got that booze, that bottle of Virginia Dare peach wine, and when it went down and something happened, things were never the same for me, buddy. Something happened to me, and when the bottle passed around a second time, I had that bottle this way, drinking it, and I got sick. And I was about 10, and I thought I was about 15, but my cousin told me I was 10 years old. And my aunt wanted to know what was wrong. Said, "Well, we don't know. He's sick." And she put me to bed and set me in front of that old potbelly stove boy. I was sick. Next day, I got up and got some of that water and drank it, and got sick all over again. And man, I can't ever remember. This thought of Virginia Dare peach wine makes me sick right now to even think of it. I don't know, but when I drank booze, something happened. Buddy, anything I asked booze to do, it did. I thought it did everybody that way, but I've come to find out a lot of people don't do that way. Man, I tell you what, I spent 4 years in the CBs, and I got on a boxing team because they got a few extra privileges, and I learned to fight with my brothers and a street fight down there in Louisville, and I was pretty good. And I remember one night I had to fight this guy, and my buddies came in to the dressing room, and Bummy Davis was wrapping my hand. Boy, he had him like concrete. And he said, you think, Ray, you think you can take this guy? We bet the money on you. And I said, man, I don't know. This guy's got reach on me, and I don't know how many fights he's had, and I never have sparred with him. I don't know. And he said, here, take a shot of old granddad. And I took a hank off that old granddad, and man, it went down to my toes. And in a few minutes, he said, what's time for you to go out? And I said, give me another hit off that, Charlie. And I knocked it down pretty good. And I said, wait a minute. I said, bet $200 on it for me. And I went out there, and man, I tell you, I don't believe it mattered who had been in that other corner. I put that guy out, man. I'm telling you what, he didn't have a shot. Now, booze did that for me. I might add that years later, I thought I could whip somebody. And it didn't, you know, it did the same thing to me, I guess, mentally, but, you know, you ain't gonna, you know, wait till I get up off the floor, I'll get you next time, but, and then, later on, I could, drink booze, you know, walk in and pick, go over that shelf and pick out one that, that had a good story in it, and I'd take that booze and I remember about 17, 18 years old when they'd thrown me out of school, and I decided to see the country and freight train it and hitchhiking. And I remember being over in Arkansas, and I'd bought me a bottle of bourbon. And I was up there in the Arkansas mountains, and I got under a tree, and there wasn't no cars coming, one about every 30 minutes to pick me up. And I got comfortable under a tree, and I took the top off that thing, threw it away. And I began to drink that whiskey. And, man, I talked to them trees. I was sitting under a pin oak tree, and this tree told me, started talking to me and told me the history of the country. How there had been great forest fires and how the bull. And I said, I didn't know trees could talk. I said, yeah. I said, how you come to talk to me? Because you understand this, Ray. And I talked to that tree, and I never just sit around and tell people I did these things. But the rest of my life, I never would just break a tree limb off. I had, you know, trees had souls to me. My brother come and asked me not long ago to come up and cut a tree down in his backyard, and I said, I'll have to go talk to it. And I went back there and talked to that pine tree and told him, I said, brother says, you know, you're going to have to go, and I'm going to do what I can for you. And my wife said, what's Ray doing? He said, well, he's going back there to talk to that tree. You know, he shook his head. And I talked him out of cutting the tree down. It's doing fine, but they don't understand me. I tell you what, I have been general of armies. I played the violin in Carnegie Hall, and I was president. I mean a great president for about 3 or 4 hours. Booze, you know, if booze did for you what it did for me, I would defy you not to take another drink. Man, here I got a gallon on each arm, and having a hell of a time, and somebody come up and tell me, man, you shouldn't drink that stuff. Hey, later on, that was when I was in the Navy. Later on, when I was a superintendent of a construction company and working about 200 or 300 men, and I was supposed to be a marriage counselor and a financial advisor, and all these people come to all these problems to me, and I tell them, come into the office, and I'd say, sit down there, and they'd start. I said, wait a minute, and I'd open that door up and pour them a drink. I said, what you need is a drink, and then we'll get to these problems. And then I'd pour them a drink, and we'd drink a few, and we'd talk a little bit. And then I said, now, what are you worried about? He said, oh, nothing. I said, see? What you need is a drink. I never did trust a guy that didn't drink. And I still don't trust anybody too much that never has. I still say they missed something, but, you know, my brother, I had three brothers and two sisters. We all had the same mother and father. We all sat at the same table and got the same instructions, and I'm the only alcoholic. So evidently there's something different about Ray. Evidently it's not in that bottle. I got a brother, a couple of brothers that drink, you know, they go to a party. Him and I go to a party and say, "Want to drink?" I say, "Yeah." And he'd say, "What do you got?" You know, he'd say, "What do you got?" And he'd order some drink. And after a while, he'd come around and say, "You want another drink?" "Yeah." And he'd say, "No, I'm feeling mine." You know, I never could understand that. Hell, he's sicker than I am. He's feeling it and he wants to stop. So if that's all that it ever did to me, you know, I wouldn't be up here talking to you tonight. Things begin to happen. I can't ever remember of having an inferiority complex. Maybe I'll discover one of these days. I really don't know whether that's a requirement or not. I sure as hell had an ego. I had a booze started causing problems in my life. When I never did really recognize it. After I got out of the Navy and traveling around, I thought, man, I'm spending all my time in bars, and you know, I think I'll drink till I'm 30 and then settle down or what have you, and you know, try this life like what these other people say you ought to do, you know. You know, maybe get a wife, you know, or some of this stuff. And I couldn't see any problem about it, even though I had been arrested already, and booze had caused me a lot of, you know, some problems, but yeah, it was just part of it. I was willing to pay that price, you know. Then, after getting married, after a while, my wife said, "You're an alcoholic." And "You're my toy." You know, I was drinking before you was born. And I was drinking when I met you. I was drunk when we got married in a blackout. And she showed me the marriage certificate the next morning. It lasted 18 years. Hell, that's a good way to pick one as any. I thought, well, you know, I always get out of it. And you know how we are. We alcoholics, I don't believe, get married. We take people hostage. Really. I've become obsessed with that girl. Really, I did. And then it came a time when I didn't want her, but I didn't want nobody else to have her either. And finally, I think she divorced me. And hell, I couldn't stand anybody else having her. I went back and courted her and married her again. It wasn't all bad, really. I had a lot of great times with that girl, and had three beautiful children. I had a girl, Jennifer, and then had another little girl, Heidi, and then had a son, Stuart. And I don't know, my drinking started picking up, and of course, like a good alcoholic, I blamed her and for causing it. When I guarantee you, if she drove me to drinking, she paid a hell of a price. She paid a hell of a price. But anyway, things started getting pretty bad. My career was going along pretty good. I was good at my work. I just built a damn building, you know, drinking and just easy. And these guys working for would say, call me into office, you know, and say, "We're worried about you, Ray." And I said, "What are you worried about?" He said, "Well, you're drinking. We're worried and concerned about your family." And I said, "Get the books out." And they say, "Yeah, they get the books out. Yeah, we know you're doing. You make more money than anybody we got, and you everybody wants to work for you. We don't know how in the world you get these buildings built, but we're concerned." "Ah, no, y'all ain't. Y'all don't appreciate me." Well, it started getting bad. It started to where I didn't come home, and I'd start drinking. It was like it was two of me. The one guy was a Little League baseball coach, and in the PTA, and all these things, and a crack superintendent, and active in the union, and this other Ray would be out drinking God, you know, anywhere, everywhere. I wouldn't plan it that way, but once I started drinking, I couldn't quit. I didn't know it at the time that I had to drink, but then I'd have that remorse the next day. You know, next time it's going to be different, and went through all that thing of trying to switching drinks and doing this and doing that and making sure that I wouldn't become an alcoholic. Didn't drink in the morning, so I wasn't an alcoholic. Then I started drinking in the morning, and I wasn't an alcoholic because I wasn't as bad as you were. And then finally, realizing that I probably was, and just joked about it, you know. But the one Ray didn't like the other one. The sober Ray didn't like that drunk. He'd get in jail, and they'd put his name in the paper, and there were a lot of DWIs. I started getting a lot of DWIs. God, I don't know how many I got. I spent a fortune on trying to keep my license. I got 3 DWIs in Louisville, Kentucky in one night. In one night, in a period of about 4 hours, you could have a bondsman in. All you had to do was make a phone call. And I'm crazy, right? Hey, what's the matter, Ray? I said, they got me locked up. And they said, let me talk to that guy. I said, turn him loose. And he turned me loose, and I back in. And he got me again. I called him again. Well, they'll be down to let you out in a few minutes. No, they already been out and back in. Turn him loose. And I decided the police were all following me, and I was going to go across the river in Indiana. And I head across that river, and I tried to miss that abutment, and it kept coming at me, and I finally missed that abutment. But when I got on the Indiana side, the one on the other side got me. Then I started having wrecks. The wife had joined the church, and they'd laid hands on me and all this stuff, and geez, you know. It just wouldn't work. And she got a pistol and threatened me, and then she, I heard her tell the kids she was going to poison me. I'm going to poison the SOB. And kind of like Wine Old Joe says, I couldn't afford a food taster, but you can bet your butt that I ate last. I never ate at home. If I ate anything at home, it was off of her plate, left over her plate. I never ate anything out of the refrigerator because I knew she was going to poison me. And then one day the son said, Mom's got a pistol, Dad. She's going to kill you. And I said, okay. And I knew where she was going to have it, right under her mattress. And so I waited till she took the kids and went somewhere. And I went up there and got the gun. Brand new Smith & Wesson. And took it down the basement and finally broke the firing pin off and ground it down and re-blued it. I thought this was normal. Really. A good way to survive. And re-blued it and put that one shell that she had in it back under there and waited. I come in one morning about 3 o'clock in the morning, and I could tell she was mad, you know. And, come on, we're going to have a talk. And we sat down at the table and started talking, and I must have said something that didn't agree with her or something. And I saw that little blood vein pop out of her head, and that Indian blood started coming out, and I knew something was going to happen. So out came that pistol. Well, I'm just going to kill you. And I said, I'm tired. I'm sick of all this fighting and this all this stuff. I said, just go ahead and shoot me. I said, wait a minute. Let me get one more drink. And I poured me about 3 ounces, and I put that cup in my mouth, and she'd had that pistol right across the table, and I thought to myself, what's that damn thing go off? I said, sure as hell it's going to go off. But anyway, she looked at me and decided not to and laid it down. Finally she moved off upstairs. She got frigid on me and moved upstairs. And I told her she's going to make a queer out of the sun. And then I was afraid she's going to kill me in my sleep. Now I got a nice home, and I go down to the basement, and I get me a 16-penny double-head nail and a 16-ounce hammer, and I go up there, and I toenail my door shut. Big oak, solid oak door. Go around and put a big garbage can in front of the one window, put my dog on the front porch, and sleep. And I thought, boy, you know, what a way to solve this problem. I thought that was normal. I did that for months. get up in the morning, pull the nail out, open my drawer, lay the nail down, the hammer next to it, go to work, come in. But it got bad. Finally, called me in and said, "Why don't you just go away and leave us alone? Go away and leave us alone." And I said, "Okay, you know, it's too much. It's just this getting violent now." And I was all screwed up, drinking really bad. And I thought maybe I could get away from her. I could do something about it. And I remember my kids come in and my little Heidi. I'll tell you a little more about Heidi in a minute. I remember my little girl Heidi. She was about 10, and said, tears running down her eyes. I said, "Oh, Daddy, don't go." Said, "Oh, you can quit drinking." Said, "Everything will be okay if you just quit drinking." And I said, "I can't." And she says, "Why, Daddy?" And I said, "I don't know." And that was truthful, see. I knew I couldn't. I done already tried to quit. And the poor little thing just crying. And, you know, a daddy knows when he's losing his kids. He ain't going to be there overnight. And, God, that's tough. So try to drown that with the booze. Drinking heavier and heavier. And of course, by now, it has progressed. And me not knowing it, but it progressed now to where I had to drink all the time. And I got drinking heavier and heavier. And I got to having wrecks. Let me back up a little bit. One time I came home from work. One morning I woke up in the middle of the night, and I had this dream. And in this dream, my wife had bought 3 dogwood trees from this guy, and had let each one of the kids hold one, and while they planted the thing down in the front yard. And in this dream, if this tree died before this kid was 18 years old, the kid would die. God, I woke up off that dream, man. I tell you, I was in a cold sweat. And man, you know how weird we are about these kind of things, this ESP bullshit and all that stuff. That worried the hell out of me, but I passed it off, didn't think too much about it until about a month later. I come home, there's 3 dogwood trees down in the front yard. And I said, "Where'd they come from?" And Jennifer said, "Oh, some guy brought them by today and sold them to me, and said, we each held one while we planted them." Boy, I just threw a fit. I cussed that woman out and went and got drunk. Really drunk. Her, you know, this just exactly like that dream was. And, of course, she didn't know what, I never told her about the dream. So I went on and I took care of them trees, you can bet. The middle tree started dying on me. And I go down there and I try everything in the world about this tree, and I'm a pretty good gardener, and I can't do nothing with it. I call Carl Ray out there, an expert, to try to save this tree. And he said, "Damn tree's dead, Ray." And I said, "It can't be." And he said, "Well, it is." And he couldn't understand why I was making such a big deal out of this tree. Well, I went in and threw another one of my fits with her. Crazy fits. And we got drunk again about it. Well, then that all went away. And that's just some of my foolishness. Well, now, my drinking progressed until I got started getting in jails a lot. And then I started having these wrecks. And wrecking all these cars. I just couldn't. When you give me a drink, you can't get my keys away from me. I'd hire a guy to take me and chauffeur me, and then when I'd start drinking, I'd fire him. So I hired this great big guy, and he'd say, "It's time to go." And I'd look at him, and I'd say, "Okay." And I'd go, and he'd take me home, and I'd wait till he left and go leave. And I'd call him up, and I'd say, "Come down to jail, get me out." And he said, "God damn right." He said, "I just took him." I said, "Yeah, but I went out again." And I tried to quit drinking. I went and talked to my family doctor, and he said, "Yeah, I drink too much too." He said, I'm going to slow down." And I thought, "Well, shit, he don't understand." I talked to other people about it. I never did talk to the guys I drank about it. Well, yes, I did. Joe Ramsey, I talked to him about it. One night was up to Monday night football, and everybody didn't want many people out on Monday night drinking. I never could understand that. What was the difference in Monday and the other night? But I looked at him, and he looked at me, and he said, "We got a problem, ain't we, right?" And I said, "Yeah, this booze." He said, yeah. I said, if you ever find a way to get off this damn booze, will you let me know, Joe? And he said, yeah, you promise me you will, too? I said, yeah. Something was happening then, but I didn't know what it was. Well, I got into a bad wreck and wound up in the hospital, General Hospital of Louisville, and they were going to take my leg off. They wanted me to sign this paper, and I said, what happened? And they said, well, you're in a bad wreck, and your leg's got to come off. And I said, no, I ain't taking my leg off. And so I called, they got me to the phone, and I called my sister, and she went crying. I knew it was going to happen. I knew it. And I said, give me a doctor. And so he got this guy that works on these motocross guys and come in, and he saved my leg. He said, you'll never be able to bend it or walk, but I'll save your leg. And I remember, when they had me in the hospital down there, I went in the DTs. They had me tied down in there, and them rats was crawling up on me, and I ripped all them IVs and everything out of my arms. And these people come tied my hands down to that bed. And then them rats eating me. I've suffered worse things. It seemed like after it was over, there was a kind of relaxed peace to it. These guys around me thought I was going through hell. Then they gave me some morphine. And boy, I went on a Technicolor trip. And I pushed that button. I said, I want some more of that. I said, we're afraid you'd get addicted. And I said, I already am. But it got bad. I tell you what, I got a little thing here I want to read. Now, I lost my marriage license. I lost my driver's license. I lost my wallet. I lost everything that the person's supposed to keep. But I got a letter in the mail one time after I left home and was living with this guy. And I kept it. And let me read for you. This is 1974. Mr. Ray Rowe, Doral Apartments, Louisville, Kentucky. Dear Mr. Rowe, perhaps you have heard of me and my nationwide campaign in the cause of temperance. Each year for the past 14 years, I made a tour of the country and delivered a series of lectures on the evils of drinking. On these tours, I have been accompanied by my young friend and assistant, Clyde Lindstrom. Clyde is a pathetic case, a young man of good family and excellent background whose life was ruined by excessive indulgence in whiskey, gin, and rum, not to mention the beer. Clyde would appear with me in my lectures and sit on the platform, drooling at the mouth and staring at the audience through bloodshot eyes while I would point out an example of what drinking could do to you. Last summer, unfortunately, poor Clyde died. A mutual friend has given me your name. And I wonder if you would care to accompany me on this summer's tour and take poor Clyde's place. That was the most devastating letter. Recuperating. One day I said, I'm going to take a little drive. I went out and I remember checking my wallet. And they found me 3 days later. In a gutter and a lipstick and the damn cast recrushed and everything. And the only thing I remember was my sister side of the bed to me crying and said, why, Ray, why? And I said, I don't know. She had to have a why. She said, is it rude? I said, yeah. It's rude. I thought so. You know, they got to have a reason, so you give them one. And they let up. And, you know, it worked for a long time. Hell, I didn't know why. I've asked myself that question a million times, why. I remember then of my wife asking me why. Why, Ray? I don't know. Was it something that happened to you when you was in the service? Yeah. My whole outfit got wiped out and I was the only survivor. I thought so. Hell, I was sober 2 years before I realized that wasn't true. Really, looking for my medal. But anyway, I decided that I was going to leave Louisville and get away from all of these things and that woman and that job, and start again. Give it one more last try. Because already down there in jails, these guys, the Alkies, had told me, Ray, you're one of us now. You might as well forget that big job you got. You can't quit. You might as well just forget all that and come with us and drink. And the judge is telling me, you got to stop this. You're from a good family. You look at the career you've got. Look what you're doing. You got to stop. And I knew the guys in the jail knew what they were talking about, and the judge didn't understand. I knew. I had this one guy tell me, said, I hear there's a way. And I said, what? And he said, Alcoholics Anonymous. And I said, does it work? And he said, they say it does. And I said, well, why don't you go to it? He said, well, I'm not through drinking yet. And I thought, God damn, he was a pure wino. And I thought, well, if he's not done, I damn sure ain't fooling with you. But anyway, I took off from Louisville and was going to Indiana and give it this one last shot and not drink anymore and get my career back on track and get me a big Cadillac and show her. But on my way to Indiana, that insanity, that obsession to drink set in. And I started getting shakes, and I started driving faster. I went in there and I said, give me a drink. I thought to myself, if you're going to quit forever, you need one last shot of bourbon whiskey to settle you down, and then tomorrow we'll go down there and talk to that guy. Makes sense to me. I went in there, and man, I tell you what, that was the best drink I believe I ever took in my life. Man, it settled me down. Well, I closed the place that night. Now, looking back, you know, I think God works in mysteries. I think God put people in my life. Because this girl sitting right here was in there working that night. And I guess if you walk like a duck, quack like a duck, and act like a duck, you're a duck. And anyway, she had been around Alcoholics Anonymous. She knew a drunk, I guess, when she saw one. But anyway, I closed that joint that night, and then this guy I worked for, he took me out to the Ramada Inn. Now, I'm getting $900 a month from this insurance company. All I got to do is make sure they can't find me. And I did that all right. And he's going to give me $400 a week, put me up in the Ramada Inn, pay all my bills in order to straighten this job out for him. And so the first night, we went up there and went in happy hour, and he bought everybody drinks. And and when it's time to go, he put $15 on there for the little girl, little Debbie, and took a turn to me and said, now, you're my superintendent. You're going to be standing here. And he said, that's the way I want you to do. And I said, I believe I can handle it. Well, brother, you know, I had that whole place drunk every night. And I was off and running again. And it wasn't a period of a few weeks that I was in all their jails, a couple more wrecks, and got in a fight. Ben's just the worst fight I ever got in. I'll tell you about that fight before I get sober here. And I was sneaking in my own apartment. By myself, sneaking in 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning or 4, whatever time the place closes. And I ain't going to turn no lights on. I'm going to get to my bed. If I can just ever get to my bed, you know, I'm home and everything's going to be all right. And I get attacked right in the middle of my living room. And we go round and round, and I tear up the damn coffee table, and the neighbors all wake up, and the lights come on, and here they come, and they found me in the bathtub. And guess who I was fighting? A rocking chair. The damn rocking chair broke 2 ribs and punctured my kidney down there, killed me, put me in the hospital for 10 days. It's sitting on my sister's porch over in Louisville. I tell people, I said, watch that chair, it's the meanest son of a bitch here. But anyway, things were getting bad. It was getting down there to where it's unending despair. No days, no nights. Can't feel no pulse. Begging somebody to bring me a bottle of wine or anything. Knowing it's killing me, yet couldn't do without it. Fear that Bill's talking about. This telephone would just drive me off the wall. Yet in those last days when that I knew I was going to die drunk, there was no way for me to ever get sober. I'd just give up on that. Yet there were a few days in there, I'd just go take a few beers and just never bother me. Never bother me. And I'd think, well, that's it. And then the next thing you know, I'm in jail again. And it was just awful. I stood in front of that mirror I would lay in, I couldn't sleep in bed. I'd lay on that floor and turn on that TV on some spiritual program if I could find it. And I think, no pulse. And I think, well, if I go, if I close my eyes, I'm going to die. And I try to think, one eye open this way. And then I think, well, if I drink that much more, I'll pass out and it'll be okay. I'd pass out. Next morning, I'd wake up alive. And I go in that mirror and I hold that bottle. Now I hate whiskey. I hate it. And I stood in front of that mirror and I said, God, what is this awful thing? Why can't I quit drinking this? Oh, why can't I quit drinking? And I'd drink it and I would vomit blood out of both ends and the meat. And it was just awful. There was just no way. And you know, you just can't hardly drink yourself to death. You get so sick, you can't eat, and then you got to quit. Then I wound up in a jail. My last drunk, I just went to get my car greased or something, I don't know. And I said, I'll go over a couple beers while you're doing that. And the next thing I know, I'm in jail. And I had parked my car in the middle of an interstate with no lights on, right in the middle of it. And they arrested me and took me to jail. And I remember thinking, well, it ain't no way I can't get sober. And next morning, Shirley knew that I was either in the hospital or in jail. And she came and got me out of that thing and took me to a treatment center like a little kid. And this guy was in AA sitting down there or somebody and said, he's ready. And then I didn't know where I was at. And they didn't have no rooms. And she said, well, he's staying here in the damn hallway. He ain't leaving. He ain't getting another drink. He'll be gone. So they put me in a room. And this guy came in. I thought he was a doctor. And he looked at me and he had this. I could see his clear, calm eyes, yet I could see all that pain back in behind his eyes. You know, you can see that pain in anybody's eyes that they've gone through. And he said, do you want to do something about that drink? I said, I'd like to. And he said, if you'll let us, we can help you. There's a way. There's a way. And he left. And I thought to myself, boy, if he only knew. Boy, if he only knew. I don't know what the hell where they got me now, but if they only knew me, they know they would never say that. Well, he came back the next day. And he came in and he said, Ray? And I said, yeah. And he said, do you still feel the same way about that not drinking? I said, yeah, man, I've been trying to get off of it for years. And then he said, well, I used to be just like you. And I'd like to help you if you'll let me. And then he told me his story. And damned if he hadn't been just like me. Now, there's where I got my desire to get sober. I thought to myself, just maybe. And then they put me in this treatment center, and they gave me this book of Alcoholics Anonymous on March 1st. And I began to read that thing, and I couldn't understand none of it. But I went to my, they took me in a room, and they had these 12 steps up there. And I said, how important are them things? I said, I've seen them on Salvation Armies all around the damn country, a lot of places. And I said, I never could see where our rules could do anything. And this guy said to me, that is gospel for you, Ray. That is your very life. And so I read them. And I, that first one, I knew that. And then I went on down to 3 there. And then I said, well, I'm done in. I don't know anything about this prayer or nothing. And he said, fake it. All you need is desire to get sober. Well, I had that and faked it. And I went to my room and said, God, if there is one, give me the courage to try this AA thing. Now, it didn't happen to me. I didn't get nothing happen. But I can tell you one thing. 2 years later, when I wondered when my obsession, this obsession to drink, had gone away, I went right back to that minute. Right back. I took the first 3 steps right that first week in Alcoholics Anonymous. And Then I began to get an appetite. The guys would come in and say, I got 2 years. And this one guy really impressed me. He had 30 days. And I said, how you doing it? You know, and I began to see these people, and they'd tell these stories, and I knew that these people were my people. I knew that they understood. Here's some people understood, I got this desire, and just maybe Ray can do it. You know, I don't know, God's made me that way, you know, say, can you do it? And I said, God damn it, you did it, didn't you? I don't know what makes me that way, but I've been that way. And why I chose, I don't have any idea. I believe it's just God touched me or something. But anyway, then I was going out of that thing, and I was afraid to leave there, and I was just hanging on to every thread I could hang on to, and I was worried about my children and worried about this. Now that I saw that I might be able to stay sober, I didn't want to go to jail. Now they'd done promised me 2 years. So he went to court with me and talked to the judge and said, he seems to be responding. You know, I was like, yeah, damn, is that all you're going to say? But I didn't know what power he carried to that court. And the judge said, everybody needs help from time to time. I'm going to give you a chance. So then I went home and I began to read, say that serenity prayer over and over and over again. And what saved my life was this book here and a lot of other people. That much of it, I said. That much. 164 pages. Well, he went to court with me, and I came home at evening, and Shirley was working, and I was laying down, and I had seen that serenity prayer, and I went to sleep, and I heard a shot. I woke up, and I felt awful uneasy. And felt real weird, and I thought, I better call Lord, something's wrong. No, it's some more of your weird stuff. That's just, everything's all right. I smoked a cigarette, and I still felt uneasy. And 2 hours later, the phone rang. And I didn't want to answer that phone. But I do, I had to. And I answered the phone. It was my sister. She said, Ray, are you by yourself? And I said, yeah. She said, oh, my God. I said, go ahead and tell me. I already know there's something wrong. I already know what I've been feeling for 2 hours. And I said, what's wrong? And she said, Heidi just killed herself. And what did I think of? The first thing I thought of, goddamn dogwood tree. She was born on Easter Sunday. And this was Good Friday. 3 days before she was 18 years old. The thing I loved in life more than myself. Loved this child was mine. And I was going to protect her from everything. The one that always stood by Dad. Never criticized her. I never... It was devastating. It was absolutely devastating. The pain is indescribable. And I went into acute depression. And I thought to myself, I could see barrels of booze like they had down there in Jamaica. And I thought, boy, if that would do it. But see, I knew in my heart that booze would just make it worse. I knew the booze long since had the booze ever relieved it. I knew there was no pill you could give me. I knew moving over there wouldn't relieve it. I knew going to Russia wouldn't relieve it. It was like a sword in my heart. I try to control that pain in my heart with my mind. It won't work. Mind finally shut off and never going to take me to a nut house. They all came in and tried to do something. I couldn't stand it. I can't. Yeah, there's some more to that, but my wife had called me and in her sickness and threatened to kill Shirley's child with the same gun and all that stuff. It was awful, but I didn't drink. The first 3 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, I thought to myself, so this is this God you all gave me. Just when I thought I got that close to it and was denied it, now this. Well, AA people carried me through that. A guy came and told me, he said, Ray, can you hear me? And I said, I shook my head, yes. And he said, try to explain to me exactly how you feel. And I began to think for some reason or other, and I said, I'm okay now, Gene. And then I had a long way to work through why I hurt so much, but joy and pain come from the same spot. And I had to learn the difference between grief and self-pity. Self-pity almost destroyed me. Then all through AA, what I learned about the real Ray, through the 4-step of what caused me was my self-centeredness and my resentments and fear of what was wrong with Ray. And I learned in AA, about prayer. You know, all my life, I thought that that men would decide what you want and then ask God to help you. In the true spiritual living, God decides. And men seeks to do God's will. If it be thy will, nevertheless, not my will, but thine be done. I had that all confused. And that's what I learned out of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I tell you what Alcoholics Anonymous means to me today is that I am not afraid anymore. I don't have any resentments of all that past, no guilt. Guilt almost started me. My sponsor said, deal with that guilt, Ray. And I don't have any guilt. I don't have any resentments. All I have to deal with is the resentments as they come up now. And the guilt that might come up now, when I'm aware of, I know exactly what to do. How would you like to be able to get up in the morning and say, you know, not have any worries? Bank's worried. Owe them some money. Just a situation, you know. The only thing I worry about is my courage and my golf swing. How'd you like to be able to get up and just take off in a 73 Chevy and just go around the country and not worry? God, what a great way to live. Not afraid anymore, not worried about anything, not having to do anything. There's children of my Jennifer who told me one time, God damn you drunken bastard. Get out of my life. I hate you, you drunken. Go away. Don't ever come back. Got a. In 1983, she sent me a little book on wildflowers. She knows I love wildflowers. This is a to my wonderful father, who has come to love life and accept those around him for who they are, whose outlook on life is a shining example for his growing daughter. I love you, Daddy. Jennifer. What would you give for that? $1 million? Couldn't buy that for $1 million. It's all free in Alcoholics Anonymous. Alcoholics Anonymous, to me, I am so interested in cooking, hobbies, playing golf, a million things. I got so many interests now that I ain't got time, so I just do nothing. And it's okay. Really. Most people sober up and go to work, and I sober up and quit. And, you know, I haven't quit, you know, God ain't through with me yet. I still living in sin and lying once in a while by choice on the golf course. But from where I came to where I am now, you know, if you're about to go through a divorce or going through one, I've been there. I know how you feel. If a judge has sent you here, I know how you feel. If you've lost loved ones, I know how you feel. And I'm telling you what, AA is the greatest way to live that you'll ever see. Living in the now, and if I could sit here and tell you that people are drunk, that I got a guy, saw him talking to a telephone pole, tricked him into an AA meeting, he's sober, sponsoring three other people now. God! I could sit here, and I spent too much time on that drunkalog, but I want to thank you all for being here, and you know, if you want to do something about your drinking, you're in the right place. I'm a living example that this AA works. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Ray. He certainly said it. Unending despair. God, how I knew it. Unending despair. Incomprehensible demoralization. God. Yeah. And I think one of the highlights for me, and one of the things I've probably talked about,
This tape was recorded by at the Central Orlando Group of Orlando, Florida, by Ray Rowe from Louisville, Kentucky, on the 21st of December, 1985.